Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show that takes you back in time. As we visit each time with World War II veterans, we're reminded that no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, men and women who have done things you probably can't imagine for the sake of our freedom. For example, if you played 18 holes in Bakersfield, California this week and saw a spry 93-year-old sinking a long putt for par, you'd probably be a little bit impressed. I'm guessing you'd be even more impressed if you found out that 93-year-old had spent 8 months as a guest of the Gestapo, as they say, a prisoner of war in Germany. If you listened to the program last time, you heard Robert Farwell explain how that all came about. It's not too often that an interview has to encompass a second episode of Hometown Heroes, but with Mr. Farwell, we just couldn't shrink it all down to fit into one. So we're going to hear the rest of his story this time. If you didn't hear part one, here comes a quick little refresher course. Originally from Duluth, Minnesota, Mr. Farwell joined the Army Air Corps before the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. He spent the early years of America's involvement in the war training bomber pilots stateside. In 1944, he headed over to Europe to take over as a squadron commander with the 306th Bomb Group. He just needed to complete 5 missions in his B-17 before he'd earn that title, but that 5th mission on September 12, 1944, saw German fighter planes come head-on and unleash a hail of gunfire. It started a fire in his cockpit, another in the number 3 engine, and Major Farwell had to give the orders to bail out. If you caught all that last time, I don't think you'll mind hearing a little bit of that again. I asked Mr. Farwell what he saw and experienced as he exited that burning airplane.
Well, I knew that there was a lot of flak. There was a lot of any airplanes. There was a lot of metal flying around. So I said, I knew that we'd been briefed that the cloud formation, the tops were at about 18,000. And the bottom of the formation was at about 4,000. So I said, I'm going to wait until I can see the ground before I open my chute, because otherwise you've got falling airplanes, you've got flak all over the place. So when I got down to the point where I was just ready to come out of the clouds at about 4,000 feet, then I pulled the ripcord and, the parachute took me down.
All right, I always try to imagine myself in the situation that the veteran is experiencing here, and this has got to be right up there with some of the scariest. In my mind, you're free-falling blindly through clouds for 14,000 feet.
From 28,000 to 4,000 feet, whatever that is.
24,000 feet, free-falling without seeing anything, really.
No, I was in the clouds.
What in the world is going through your head?
I was waiting to see the ground.
Were you scared at all?
Not really. You don't have time to get scared. You're just figuring what do you have to do? What do you do? What are you going to do? Where's the ground? And that's about it.
So you pull your chute, and then I imagine everything slows down a little bit.
Oh, yeah. By the time the chute opens and everything's calmed down, you're probably at about 2,000 or 3,000 feet. And fortunately, I'm about 40 miles just east of Berlin, and it's just farm country. And I'm floating down there looking at a hayfield, level and flat. When I'm at about 1,500 feet, I see a farmer with a pitchfork running towards where I'm going to be landing. And as I landed, he's there right with me. So there was no evasion, no escape, no nothing. So, as the saying goes, for you the war is over.
Yep, and he told us about becoming a prisoner of war, eventually taken to Stalag Luft I in Barth, Germany, where the food and Red Cross parcels helped keep him alive. He did lose a good deal of weight, but would have lost a lot more if he had to rely on the occasional potato or that infamous German bread made with tree flour. That's a euphemism for sawdust, of course. That's pretty much where we left off last time, with Mr. Farwell in the POW camp, believing that his freedom would be regained someday. And that's where we're going to pick it up now.
Another thing that you brought home with you was this wartime log. And there's some evidence in there of how you spent a lot of your time as a prisoner. And I understand you kind of helped other guys keep their minds occupied too?
Yeah, we had, we did the best we could. We arranged in September, October, and early November time periods. We had a bunch of baseball teams. Every one of the buildings put a team. We probably had a half a dozen baseball teams and ran a little league. And I arranged to have a basketball coming through the Red Cross. I had a basketball and a net. I needed a pole and a backboard. So I arranged with the Germans to put a pole in and enough wood to have a backboard so that I could put up this net. The pole went in the ground. One day, the next morning, the pole was gone.
Can't let you have too much fun, huh? You know, I think for the baby boomer generation, when they think of prisoners of war, maybe the first thing that comes to mind is the long-running TV show Hogan's Heroes. And some of the real POW stories we've heard on this show sound a little more like those fictionalized plot lines than others. So I think people can maybe imagine a Sergeant Schultz type tearing down your basketball hoop. But was this the guards just being mean, or is it something you think that was maybe just lost in translation?
Some of the guys, they didn't understand what was going on, so they pulled the pole down, and how they cut it up, I don't know, but they did, and it ended up being firewood in a couple of the lodges.
So much for that. Maybe they were just bitter that the USA had come onto German soil and won the Olympic gold medal in basketball in Berlin in 1936. And one of the things I was referring to in relation to your wartime log, there are some very well-done watercolors of downhill skiers that you created in captivity. Did you learn to paint while you were a POW?
Well, I did those, but I had a little, you know, the stuff earlier. So it was just something to do.
Yeah, you had to keep your mind occupied, to keep going and going and hoping you would eventually taste freedom again.
When that liberation came, what was that like for you? I'm sure you had dreamt about that moment for a while.
Oh, yeah, it was an exciting time. What happened is the Russians were coming close. The Germans were going to, they said, all get ready, we're gonna walk west and get out of here. And Zemke talked to the German commander and said, we're not going.
This is Colonel Hub Zemke, who is a P-47 ace, I believe, right?
He is Colonel Zemke. He actually, he headed a P-51 outfit at that time, the same group that Jerry Johnson and Gabreski were in. He was the commander.
Yes, Johnson was your roommate there at Stalag Luft 1, and you mentioned another ace pilot, Gabby Gabreski, who was also a prisoner of war there. And after I get your take on Zemke's impact, I think we might take a little detour. I've actually had the privilege of interviewing several prisoners from this specific camp, Stalag Luft 1, and we've alluded to Zemke's impact before, but when you take the time to examine it, I think his story is really pretty remarkable. There are so many examples of one man's courage having a great impact on his fellow soldiers, or fellow airmen in this case. And even though we're focusing on Mr. Farwell's experience, I think a nutshell sketch here is going to make it clear that Hub Zemke's character and courage had an impact on Mr. Farwell and every other prisoner at Stalag Luft 1. So we'll elaborate on that in a moment. But first, what's your understanding of how Zemke intervened? He was the ranking American there, so he basically represented all the American prisoners in dealing with the Germans?
Right, he was the ranking American. And he told the Germans, you know, we're not going to go if you force us to leave. You know, the war's over. We're going to find you and you're going to be in trouble. And the next morning, all the Germans were gone. And we just waited. Some of the guys took off, you know, heading west. But, you know, 99% of the people, there were 8,000 of us, waited, and in a couple of days, B-17s flew in and took us all to a place in France where we spent about a week.
Is that Camp Lucky Strike?
Yeah, Camp Lucky Strike. All of us probably put on about 10 pounds because all of a sudden there was all sorts of food.
Yeah, I've had some guys tell me they got a little too excited, ate too much, and got sick.
Yeah, I think that happened to a lot of people.
But not you, huh?
Not me, no.
good thing. And again, there are always a lot of what ifs on this show. I do think this is a big what if. And you can find much more along these lines online if you do some research. You can even find video of prisoners being evacuated from Stalag Luft 1 68 years ago. But let's focus on Hub Zemke for a moment, because his bravery certainly impacted Mr. Farwell and all those other prisoners. Bear with a little monologue from yours truly here as I give you a little background on Hubert Zemke. He was born in Missoula, Montana, the son of German immigrants, grew up speaking German and English, and he picked up the nickname Hub as a promising teenage boxer. When he was 22, his friends talked him into trying out for pilot training, and he joined the Army Air Corps in 1936. He was one of those Americans who was actually flying in the war before the U.S. was in the war, because Zemke went to England in 1940, flew as a combat observer with the Royal Air Force. At that point, he studied both the RAF and the German Luftwaffe and how they operated. That would come in handy later. In 1941, still before Pearl Harbor, Zemke was sent to the USSR. He helped train Russian pilots flying P-40 Tomahawks on a lend-lease program with the U.S. Once America did enter the war, Zemke checked out the P-47 Thunderbolt and commanded the 56th Fighter Group. That was the first group to fly the P-47, and a group that would receive great acclaim. They called them Zemke's Wolfpack because of the remarkable success in shooting down enemy aircraft that that group enjoyed. Zemke became an ace three times over in the P-47. In August of 1944, he transferred to the 479th Fighter Group to fly the new P-51 Mustang. In fact, he's thought to be one of the first to shoot down a German jet fighter while he was flying his Mustang. But on October 30th, 1944, in what was his 154th combat mission of the war, Hub Zemke's P-51 lost a wing in unexpected turbulence, and he had to bail out over enemy territory. Now you know how he ended up with Bob Farwell and 8,000 others at Stalag Luft 1. Although, actually, there is quite a story about some Zemke heroics between his capture and the time he ended up at Stalag Luft 1. They say the train he was being transported in came under fire by Allied fighter planes. We've heard POWs describe moments like that. Apparently, Zemke realized that he wasn't going to be able to escape, but he also realized the fighters were coming back around for another pass, and he went back into the rail car and rescued two German girls from the line of fire. That action earned him a certain degree of respect from his captors, and it gave him a little bit of standing as the unofficial commander of all the Allied prisoners at Stalag Luft 1. As Mr. Farwell described, when Russian forces were closing in and the camp commandant ordered all the prisoners to march out of Stalag Luft 1, Zemke refused that order, and communicating clearly in the German he had learned as a boy in Montana, he convinced the Germans to leave quietly in the night and essentially turn Stalag Luft 1 over to the prisoners. Remember, he had also helped train Russian pilots before America entered the war, so now 5 years later, when the Russians arrived in Barth, he used the little Russian language he had picked up to befriend those incoming forces and arrange for all the prisoners to be flown out of there in B-17s. Now, who knows how it all would have turned out if Colonel Zemke had not been there, but that's a little background. Robert Farwell remembers all of that. He still has his Kriegi card, the German index card with his mugshot and the POW number 5674. You can find a photo of that on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, a reminder of those 8 months as a prisoner of war. But I guess there is a question I need to ask you.
What did it feel like to be a free man again? And did you have a little perspective on what freedom meant after spending 8 months as a prisoner?
It was really great. I mean, it was a thrilling thing to be out. You know, you really felt great. And then the big thing then was, when am I going to get out of here and get home?
Yeah, you had a wife to go hunt down.
Yeah.
And how did that unfold? What was that like?
We ended up at Camp Lucky Strike. We were there, we were probably there about a week. And then we ended up on a ship that left Le Havre and landed in New York. We were all given the ability to get to a phone. And so actually I called my sister-in-law because there was at the family ranch where my wife was living. They didn't have a phone yet. So sister-in-law lived in Bakersfield. I got a hold of her. Then I managed to get my wife at her place, and I talked to my wife a couple of times, and she ended up going up to Sacramento. We ended up getting on a train and going across the country, dropping people off on the way. And I ended up then in Sacramento and met my wife at a hotel there.
What was it like to actually see her face again?
It was great, yeah. It's hard to describe.
From the sound of it, you never doubted that that was going to happen. And you haven't struck me as an overly sentimental guy or one that gets too emotional about things, but I've had a lot of other POWs tell me that when they sailed into New York Harbor, that there was something else they saw that had a particular significance to them. Did you see the Statue of Liberty? Did it mean anything to you?
Oh, yeah. We went right past it, you know. No, that was thrilling to see that. You could almost spit at it. We were, at least that's the way you felt. No, that was a great sight. It was a good moment.
I think a lot of people assume, hey, if I went off to war, I got shot down, could have easily died, survived 8 months as a POW, that's enough of the military for me. But that wasn't the way you thought about it.
No, I didn't. I stayed in. I loved to fly. I stayed in until November of 46. When the war was over with, I was stationed at various places, Castle and San Bernardino, I decided to get out. I said, if I'm not going to be a permanent regular officer, you know, I don't want any part of it. I got out of the service and applied to go to school at USC and Stanford, and I was accepted to both. But I went to USC because I could start in January. Stanford was on a quarter system, and I couldn't start there until March. So that's how I ended up going to USC.
But you weren't there long before the military came back and said, hey, we've got a job for you after all.
In May, I got a message from the Air Force that I was offered a regular commission. And I replied, I said, I like that very much, but I'm in school. And I'd like to finish the year so that the credits are worth something. And they said, well, when's the school over with? And I said, it finishes on the 1st of September. And they said, well, you've got until the 1st of September to make up your mind then. About a week before classes were over, we were in final exams, I got a hold of the Air Force and said, yes, I'd like to come back in. So they said, okay. Just wait for orders, and that's what I did.
And what was your expectation? Did you think you'd be back in the air flying again, or what were you anticipating?
Oh, yeah, I figured I would continue flying. And so on, the Air Force did not have a program for doctors at that time, which I was in pre-med, and I asked them about. But they said, still have a program where you can finish if your education was cut short or interfered with by the war. So as soon as I got my orders and back at Merced at Castle, I penned in for training for the Civil Institutions Program. And I was accepted after a few months. And that's the way I ended up at USC in the Civil Engineering Program.
So you left USC to go back into, I guess, what was still the Army Air Corps at that time. And then they sent you back to USC to study engineering.
Yes, went back to USC for 2 years. Graduated, got my civil engineering degree. For the last week, just waiting for orders, where I was going to go next.
And you would end up in the Air Force all the way until 1966. You first entered the National Guard in 1936. So for the better part of 30 years, you were serving our country. But what you did those last 15 years or so in the Air Force was a lot different from what you were doing in World War II. And we're going to explore that when we come back. 93-year-old Robert Farwell of Bakersfield, California, our guest again today. Speaking of Bakersfield, we had a gentleman named Don Westfall on last month talking about Minterfield Air Museum, where he continues to volunteer as a docent 70 years after he trained there as a pilot. Since that episode with Don, the original Roadhouse Grill in Bakersfield has stepped up to sponsor Don's journey to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., through Kern County Honor Flight. I'm really excited for you, Don. And hey, Original Roadhouse Grill, well done. No matter where you're listening to Hometown Heroes today, there is an Honor Flight hub pretty close to you, and I'm about to tell you more about that. We'll get back to Robert Farwell's story when Hometown Heroes continues next after this.
If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there, free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkernCounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, CVHonorFlight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.